The Bitcoin Standard Toolkit is a selection of Bitcoin services I recommend to my readers and learners on SaferDean.com as they upgrade their monetary operating system from the fiat standard to the Bitcoin standard. These companies are NYDIG, a leading full-service financial services firm dedicated to Bitcoin, applying institutional wisdom and ingenuity to help clients access the unrealized potential of this emerging asset class. NYDIG offers the full suite of solutions needed for financial institutions to access Bitcoin, including custody, execution, financing, treasury solutions, integration partnerships, and more. The team behind NYDIG brings decades of experience in the financial markets and passion for sound money to help provide the rails that will bring about a move to the Bitcoin standard. I have been working as a consultant for NYDIG for 2 years now, and I'm very impressed with their vision, focus, and execution. Go to NYDIG.com to learn more. CipherSafe. To secure your Bitcoins, it is important to keep your seed phrase backed up safely, and for that, I highly recommend using the CipherWheel Seed Storage Device, a gorgeous and brilliant sturdy piece of low-time preference engineering from a fourth-generation machine shop in Maine. The CipherWheel is machined from solid stainless steel, and its unique and elegant design is inspired by secret decoder rings, as well as legendary mechanical engineer Franz Rouleau and the golden age of machine design. If you've read the Bitcoin Standard, you'll know I think the late 19th century was a golden age for many facets of human advancement because of hard money. Bitcoin is bringing hard money back, and our friends at CipherSafe are giving Bitcoin the low-time preference machines it deserves from the golden age of design. Go to CipherSafe.io to get the CipherWheel for your Bitcoins. OKCoin. Whenever someone asks me how to invest in Bitcoin, my advice is to accumulate Bitcoins periodically for the long run, or what is called dollar cost averaging. When you buy every day, week, or month, you channel Bitcoin's volatility to your advantage. In the long run, this strategy will outperform every other Bitcoin investment strategy, probably, except for amazing luck, perhaps. The best place to do recurring purchases is OKCoin because they have the lowest fees for recurring Bitcoin purchases you will find anywhere. If you're stacking sats for the long run, every sat matters, and the fees with each purchase will add up. That's why I recommend you buy at the lowest cost possible from OKCoin. OKCoin is also the Bitcoin exchange available in the most countries around the world, so it will hopefully be accessible for you wherever you are. Go to OKCoin.com to get started with your stacking. Nodal 1. As discussed in the Bitcoin Standard, Bitcoin is controlled by the nodes that operate its software. It is only through consensus between nodes that the Bitcoin blockchain continues to live, and it is only by running a Bitcoin node that you are part of this consensus and can verify the validity of the transactions you receive and the ownership of your coins. Whenever anyone asks me what are the most important warning signs that something is wrong with Bitcoin, I always answer the following. If the number of Bitcoin nodes is declining, and or the cost of running a node is rising significantly. I believe it is really important to run a node, but I don't recommend running it on your work or personal computer as it can compromise the performance of your computer and, more importantly, the security and privacy of your Bitcoin node. A far better solution is to buy a dedicated hardware node, and for that, I highly recommend Nodal. Manage all your Bitcoin activity, such as Lightning or BTC Pay server, and isolate them from your personal computer by putting them into one dedicated device that is always running and does one thing only, Bitcoin. Become a first-class Bitcoin citizen by running your own Nodal node, available at nodal.it, and that's spelled N-O-D-L.it. Finally, Cold Card. My hardware wallet of choice is the Cold Card. I strongly recommend only conducting Bitcoin trades on computers that are dedicated to Bitcoin and cannot connect to the internet. I like the Cold Card because it is a contained machine optimized for Bitcoin and Bitcoin only. Cold Card is basically a small computer that can only do Bitcoin, which makes securing it more straightforward. Use the code BitcoinStandard on coldcardwallet.com to get a 5% discount. Hello, welcome to the Bitcoin Standard podcast. In today's seminar, we have a group of our attendees who have taken the courses at SaferDean.com, and we will be discussing some questions related to Bitcoin and economics. And in particular, we will be starting off with some bit of very interesting recent news, which we heard yesterday, where MicroStrategy, our good friend Michael Saylor, who was on this show before, in this seminar, I should say, MicroStrategy is now raising $550 million in debt to buy Bitcoin. And this is absolutely amazing as a piece of news. It would essentially raise $550 million by debt instruments. And they on Monday, they announced 400. On Tuesday, they said 200. It'll be 550. And the way that they're doing it is that they're issuing 0.75% convertible senior notes that would be sold in a private offering to qualified institutional buyers. And I think there is a lot that this move tells us about this. First of all,
just how easy it is for MicroStrategy to secure funding at this rate, the fact that they're offering this at this price, which is essentially very, very cheap. It's 0.75%. So for $400 million at 0.75%, the servicing of that debt is $3 million. And $3 million a year, which is 10% of MicroStrategy's free cash flow. And so with that amount of interest, they're able to secure $400 million that they could, with $3 million of cash flow, of their cash flow every year, they can secure the $400 million, which they could use to buy Bitcoin. And this is an enormously bold move from Michael Saylor. But it's some people have portrayed it as if it is a risky gamble. But I think that's not really accurate, because if you look at their financial position and if you look at their holdings and the value of their company, I think that it's they're not taking a massive risk with this. They've already performed very well because of the increase in the value of Bitcoin that has happened to them, that has happened to their Bitcoin reserves. And it seems like there is a big appetite on Wall Street and among institutional buyers for getting exposure to Bitcoin. And buying notes from MicroStrategy seems like it could be one way to get this exposure. And so these notes, I mean, on top of just the low interest that they're offering on them, on top of that, they are convertible into stock at the discretion of the of MicroStrategy. MicroStrategy will decide if they will convert them into stock at the end. And it is also a five-year note, which I think is interesting and opportune timing for Bitcoin and for MicroStrategy, because if we look at our other friend who has also been on this seminar, Plan B, who was with us last week, if we listen to Plan B's model, Bitcoin's value is going to increase, supposedly, after the halving. The way that model works, because the stock to flow rises, and then the new supply that is coming onto the market declines, and that leads to a price pump after the halving, which we've seen happen with both halvings, and we're seeing happen now with a third halving. So if we were to hold and to continue with this halving, we've had a small pump so far by historical standards, but if this were to continue as the stock to flow model would predict and as the kind of analysis of market dynamics would predict, if this were to continue, we'd expect to have a bull market in Bitcoin in 2021 and a bull market in Bitcoin in 2025. And so effectively, these five-year notes will finance buying Bitcoin just before one bull market and then right after the second one. So it could be quite powerful as a move. If you think about having done that, let's say between 2012 and 2017, or let's say early 2013 to early 2018, it would have been a massive move because it would have contained two bubbles, two rises in the price of Bitcoin. So we're witnessing something like this happen. So this is an incredible move from our man, Michael Saylor. We salute him and thank him for his service. And I think the other interesting thing about it is that this is essentially maybe the most interesting thing about it is that it is a speculative attack on the dollar as described and discussed by Pierre Rochard many, many years ago. In that paper, in that blog post on the Nakamoto Institute website, which I highly recommend, on a speculative attack, Pierre Rochard essentially discusses this. He says, think about what George Soros and other big financial market players will do to countries that inflate their money and are in a precarious fiscal position. They'll speculate against the currency by borrowing the currency and essentially, the way the speculative attack is, you borrow the currency and then you buy other assets and you short the currency. I think that was the way that it works. And so effectively, this is kind of what Michael Saylor is doing here, because he's borrowing money from the fiat markets and using it to buy Bitcoin, and in effect, increasing the demand for Bitcoin and moving significant amounts of capital into Bitcoin. So this is absolutely mind-blowing if you think about the implications of it. Because the amount of capital that is in the fiat markets is huge, and it is looking for a safe haven. And if this continues to work out fine for people like Michael Saylor, it's highly likely that we're going to be seeing more and more people join this stampede, or, you know, the Saylor will launch a bit of a stampede effectively if more and more money will find its way into this kind of instrument so that it can finance more and more Bitcoin purchasing. It's absolutely incredible to think about the consequences of it. So what do you guys think? Anybody have any thoughts on this?
It's
brilliant.
Brilliant. Indeed. Daniel?
Yeah, it is brilliant. And as we were discussing just before, I can't believe the price action. When somebody announces publicly to the world, to everybody that is watching the Bitcoin price, that they are going to buy 400 million at the time was the first announcement. $400 million is going to come and buy it. And we know he's all going to hold it. He's going to hold it. He's not trading it. We know this information, and the price tanks. I'm speechless. I don't get it. And I would love to, I don't know, anyone out there have any idea why, what is happening there?
Well, there's a lot of crazy stuff going on in the USA right now. I don't know if it's related to that.
I mean, I think, you know, with the price tanking, you have to always remember with Bitcoin, if it's when you get a big rise like what we saw in the last couple of months, when we've gone from like 11, 12,000 to 19,000, generally when you see these things happen, you will get a retrace after that. It's just, you know, the market, the price increases quite significantly. And I think just the way to think about it, the way that I like to think about it is, when the price rises very quickly, the amount of the value of the new Bitcoin that is being produced rises a lot. And so Bitcoin just becomes more inflationary. The value of the new coins that's coming onto the market every day is higher. And so we need larger and larger amounts of new money to come in and keep the price high. So it's natural that you're going to get this pattern of overshooting and then dropping and then undershooting and then rising and then overshooting and undershooting. So we'll see those. And I think, you know, if you look at the big bull markets in 2013 and 2017, you did see large, you know, when you look now, you just see one big giant spike. But if you look closer, you see there were very large drops during those spikes. It would go down 20, 30, 40% over a day or two or a few days. So in that sense, you know, it's probably good news in the way of thinking about just the fact that news items like this don't really affect the price so much is kind of encouraging, because it means that Bitcoin's liquidity is growing further and further. On the other hand, there's also, you know, the fact that the more this money, there's also the fact that, you know, I think everybody who's bullish is already extremely bullish. And, you know, if you've already heard about Michael Saylor and all of these things, it's, I don't know how much this one is going to change in how much you actually move into it, how much you move in terms of capital into Bitcoin. So maybe it just wasn't that much of an influence, because I think, you know, got to remember, there's still not very people, there's still not very many people that are following what is going on. We still need to pump much more in order to get more and more attention. People just don't care. Most people don't even know what Bitcoin is. Remember, you know, Bitcoin is still at 0.3% of financial markets, of the money supply, let alone financial markets. And so it's still completely misunderstood by the vast majority of people in markets. And it's going to be a while, I think, before we get that. Maybe. We'll see.
It's hard to get that it's not understood. It's so huge that it doesn't seem that it's early or small, because it's so huge. You know, there's a real disconnect there.
But it's really not. It's not huge. Like, you know, the value of bonds. How much is the global bond market at this point? It's got to be more than $100 trillion. Can't remember the exact number now, but. It's huge, hundreds of trillions of dollars in bonds. You know, Bitcoin is hundreds of billions of dollars. So,
the concept is so huge. The potential is so overwhelmingly huge, I guess, that's where, me, the disconnect is.
Yeah. Chris is saying.
To what extent do we really think that Bitcoin's price history so far has been driven by news and announcements? It doesn't seem to have been driven by them that much. What seems to have driven it is actual people coming onto exchanges and making purchases and money coming in. So isn't that a potential reason why, you know, it might not affect it very much? Because most people, it tends to be sort of more of a speculative thing that responds more directly to supply and demand at the moment, at least, than maybe being affected too much by, you know, what's going on in the real world and announcements from people.
I think so. I agree. I think since about, I would say, 2017, 2018, news has stopped really mattering to Bitcoin's price. I think you look at the price, it's followed it's followed Plan B's model of just thinking about it in terms of stock to flow. It's oscillated around that prediction, and you can see it oscillating as a result of just market dynamics overshooting and undershooting that kind of general price level, and you don't see much significance for news. I'd say earlier, up until 2017, you did have this kind of, all right, the news just broke Bitcoin and Bitcoin just dropped because somebody announced this or somebody announced that. And obviously this year in 2020, when you had, you can't really say Corona was news. It wasn't Bitcoin really reacting to news. It was a global liquidity crunch all over the world that hit all the world's markets. So I guess you can't really say in 2020, but in 2017, it used to happen that a press release would come out and say China's banning Bitcoin and Bitcoin would drop 30%. And then, you know, it'll be back up in a couple of weeks, but it still would move at news. Like if you look at the price on 2015, 16, 17, you see dumps and pumps. And if you remember what was going on back then, it would be very difficult to argue that these weren't related. You know, some major news item comes up and Bitcoin dumps. But it hasn't really happened, I think, since then. Since 2018, it's not really been the case. We've had, you know, regulations and news about, you know, we've had news and good news and bad news come up. And still, you know, we spent the period between the two halvings previously, it was all spent around $7,000-$8,000, with variation down to $3,000 and up to $19,000 for a few weeks here and there. But mostly it was around $7,000-$9,000. And, you know, maybe you can't really point at a particular point and say, you know, this news item started the bear market or that news item started the bull market. It's just market dynamics. It overshot and it undershot. And somebody mentioned in the chat, it's also when Saylor announced the first purchase, I don't really remember the price reacting. It's I think people, you know, the majority of people that are into Bitcoin are into Bitcoin at this point, having developed a pretty good understanding of the case for it. And so a bit of news like this is not going to make that much news, you know, because you've understood the Bitcoin value proposition and you've decided to make an allocation for it. Now, obviously, when something like this can happen, it can help you revise your allocation upward, make you become more bullish, possibly. But maybe, you know, for many people, there's only so much bullishness you can have. Like, there's a limit on how much money you can put in, ultimately. You know, you only have so many chairs to sell and buy Bitcoin. So for those people, the news is insignificant. And for many other people for whom, you know, the financial position is much more about long-term planning, they don't let day-to-day news detract their investment thesis. So for those people, the news is insignificant. And then for the vast majority of 99% of the world who don't even know about Bitcoin and have zero allocation for Bitcoin, for the vast majority of them, this news is insignificant. Some who are on the margin will come in. But I think the market now is big enough that the price, as determined by the holders, holding essentially, is big enough that the liquidity is large enough that individual news items don't make that much of a difference. And I think, you know, moving forward, I hope this continues, because this is essential for Bitcoin's success. In order for Bitcoin to succeed, it needs to have a low saleability, needs to have high saleability, which means that, you know, there's less volatility in its price when you try and sell it. You're less likely to have, you're less likely to experience significant variation in its price, and it becomes more and more predictable. It's going to have to overcome those things. But yeah, it's still a little early now. I think now, you know, this news gets priced in slowly, but it also gets priced in just, you know, when the actual buying happens. You know, it's one thing to say that we're going to buy $550 million. It's when you actually turn up with the 550 million fiat tokens, that's different. You know, you're dumping $500 million of fiat. That's going to make a difference in the Bitcoin market much more than the news. I think the focus that people have on, because of the rational expectations model and the efficient market hypothesis, people seem to think that it's only the news that matters, and it's not the actual liquidity. It's not the actual money that you bring onto the market. And I think Bitcoin has shown the opposite. It's, you know, talk is one thing, but bringing the actual goods, bringing the actual cash in, is what really makes the difference.
Yeah, price don't represent information. It represents transactions.
It's a very, very, very good point. Yeah, it's true. I mean, I guess there is information that comes out of it, but yeah, it can communicate information, but yeah, it is based on transactions. You're correct. Now, some people have been comparing Michael Saylor to the Hunt brothers. And the Hunt brothers, whom I mentioned in the Bitcoin Standard, they were two rich, very, very rich people in the 1970s who decided that they wanted to re-monetize silver. They wanted to make silver into money. And, you know, in the 1970s, the U.S. had gone off the gold standard, and the gold standard was, and the price of the dollar was crashing next to gold. Price of gold was rising. Price of everything was rising. The 1970s witnessed enormous inflation. And so a lot of people were anti this move, and they wanted hard money. Some of these were the Hunt brothers, who decided they're just going to pump silver forever. They just kept on buying silver, and the more silver they bought, the more that the price of silver went up. And then the more that the price of silver went up, the more that other people realized what the Hunt brothers were doing, and the Hunt brothers were open about it, I think, and the more that other people bought in silver, and then the more that the price of silver pumped, and then everybody would get richer, and everybody who got in on silver would get rich, And then silver will displace the dollar and we'd have a silver standard. That was the Hunt Brothers plan, which sounds like it, well, we don't know about the intent of Saylor, and it seems Saylor is not, you know, he's said publicly that he's not out there to target, he doesn't want to fight the monopoly of the currency. So the Hunt Brothers were, I think, explicit about the fact that they wanted to reinstall silver as money. So maybe that that part of the comparison doesn't really hold. But what does hold is the fact that they were both buying a lot of this commodity and stockpiling it with a lot of money. So the Hunt Brothers story ended up in catastrophe because the price of silver crashed and they went from being extremely rich to being, you know, average, normal, rich. And they lost a significant, enormous chunk of their fortune by putting all of their money in silver and then witnessing their silver collapse. So is this going to be the fate of Michael Saylor and MicroStrategy? Will they just keep pumping Bitcoin to the moon and then Bitcoin crashes and then the whole world will laugh at them and there'll be a cautionary tale about why you don't buy Bitcoin? Why do you think not? Or why do you think so, if you do? Anybody have any ideas?
Well, aren't we still dealing with the law of supply and demand? What am I missing here? It seems like other people are going to still be getting in as people become more and more aware of what Bitcoin is and what the potential is.
Okay, well, they also got in on silver and then that crashed.
I'd say the key difference is that with silver, you can respond by producing more. And silver is much easier to produce, has a much higher, much lower stock to flow ratio than even gold. And with Bitcoin, you cannot respond to an increase in price with an increase in supply.
Exactly. Yeah, I think this is the difference. It's why silver is basically becoming a shitcoin, because it couldn't monetize on its own, even with the Hunt Brothers trying to pump it, because ultimately silver is becoming easy. It's easy to produce enormous quantities of silver and pump them. And so what the Hunt Brothers ended up doing is donating their wealth to silver miners. Silver miners made a killing during that year. And they made it from the Hunt Brothers and the people who were mining all of that extra silver, who got into the mining industry because they flooded the market with silver. And to be fair, with silver, it isn't just mining. In the case of silver, it was also people going into their old grandma's attics and getting the old silver and melting it down and selling it. Well, not melting it, but just selling it to people who will melt it down. There's an enormous amount of silver that's in household items all over the world. People have been using it for a very long time, and you know, gold bugs and silver bugs like to talk about this as if it is a reason why their money is better. You know, our money, well, you can always make a spoon out of our money. You know, it's an app coin, as the shitcoiners call it. That it's not just money, silver. You can also make teacups out of it, and you can make all these other useful things. And of course, that's a problem for the monetary standard, because when you have all of those things, as we saw with the Hunt Brothers, you know, this was part of the problem that the Hunt Brothers, why the Hunt Brothers were screwed, because not only were silver miners all over the world digging for silver, but also everybody would dig into their grandma's attic and find whatever silverware she had and go and sell it. And so there's an enormous amount of accumulated silver that's held up in the market all over the world, held up in people's homes all over the world. Part of it doesn't really count as part of the monetary supply, so it's not part of the stockpile of gold, of silver. It's not part of the monetary stockpile of gold because it's not liquid and it's not being traded and it's not held as a financial asset. But when the price spikes, it starts becoming worth a lot more than just the silverware in which it is stored. And so it makes sense to sell it. And that's massively inflationary, because it just, you know, when the price of silver went up in 1980 to $50 an ounce, Basically, that meant that the cheap silverware that your grandma had suddenly became extremely expensive. Like you could maybe buy a car from selling her tea set. And so people took the tea sets and bought cars and bought other things with it. And so that inflated the supply and pumped and dumped silver and caused the price of silver to collapse. And that is why I think things are different with Bitcoin. You know, we may experience big dumps with Bitcoin. We may experience large crashes, but I doubt that in 5 years, you know, in 5 years' time, the production of Bitcoin is going to be half of what it is today. So right now we're making 900 Bitcoins a day. In 5 years' time, we're going to be making 450 Bitcoins a day only. And so, you know, 5 years, more people are going to learn about Bitcoin. Bitcoiners are going to make more money and want to put more money into Bitcoin. And new people are going to bring in more money into Bitcoin. But there is no silver tea set in anybody's basement. There's no Bitcoin tea set in anybody's basement that can do this thing that silver does. There's no way to dump Bitcoin on the market beyond that amount. And there's no way that the miners can make more. The miners cannot make more Bitcoin. They cannot dump more Bitcoin on the market. So with this restraint on the supply that silver didn't have, you're always going to have something similar with you're always going to have some kind of floor set on the price almost. Well, I mean, it's not really true to say a floor, but I think it's clear that with Bitcoin, you know, we haven't gone under $1,000 in 5 years, and it's looking increasingly likely that we'll never go under $1,000 again, most likely. You know, there's just far more dollars being produced and far fewer Bitcoins being produced. And so it's hard to see that we could ever restore the exchange ratio that we had 5 years ago between Bitcoin and the dollar at that rate. It's hard to see that we could restore this when so many more dollars are being produced than Bitcoin, you know? So if we're heading in that direction, that's, I think, what makes the difference. With silver, you could always just find ways of producing more and more silver, and there's no guarantee. Plus, of course, you know, you can send Bitcoin halfway around the world, but you can't do the same with silver. So there's that. Another thing worth mentioning is, in general, somebody was asking me, Theo, before the seminar, was asking me about topics to research in Bitcoin, a topic to write about. I think this is probably something that's worth looking into, that not enough people have analyzed the basic supply and demand dynamics of the Bitcoin market. And I think more could be done about it. People are used to overcomplicated thinking almost. And so you see all this extremely sophisticated mathematical analysis that is done on Bitcoin, but not as much on the basics of the supply and the demand, the dynamics of how much money is going onto the, how much money is going into Bitcoin, how much new Bitcoin is being produced. I think it would be interesting to see studies, data that looks at the price, at the market value of daily production of Bitcoin and how that has changed over time, and then see what trends we see with that. You know, when you factor in the changes in the Bitcoin supply and the changes in the price, you see this. It'll be interesting to explore that, because ultimately this is the, you know, the value of the new Bitcoin that are produced every day multiplied by the price of Bitcoin is roughly the amount of money that enters Bitcoin every day. Because that's the price that is, that's how we end up with the price at which we are. So it's interesting to examine that. And I think with all of these large purchases that are happening, you know, trying to understand how these purchases are happening and how they relate to mining volume and the value of mining that might be something worth looking into. Especially, you know, now with all these major, because now as public companies enter, all of their purchases are going to be public, and these are going to be maybe the biggest purchases of Bitcoin. So we can have public data on how much money is flowing in and how that is being used. And we can correlate that, you know, we can look at the relations between that and the price movements. I think that would be an interesting avenue of research worth looking into. Right. Any other thoughts?
Yeah, I've got a question for you.
Yep.
You know, one of the things I was listening on one of your podcasts, my question is always like, how could the fiat standard exist, or like, what are the benefits of it? And you mentioned that like the saleability across space seems to be the real value, and it's a little bit more short term. Could you explain like why there's, you know, almost like $100 trillion or arguably $300 trillion of kind of fiat currency, or at least like denominated debt in fiat currency, and how these things might play off each other, the store value use case versus being able to send money across time and space, if that makes sense. Do you understand my question, or does that make sense?
Yes. That's really, honestly, that's like the crux of the fiat standard. The fiat standard is precisely on this question, because on the one hand, effectively, fiat gives us a better saleability across space. And so people want to put their money in it because they can send it halfway around the world very quickly for relatively cheap, or for cheaper than all the other options until Bitcoin came along. But what that does is that then creates an incentive to monetize debt, because fiat is essentially credit. It's essentially somebody saying, all right, I'll send you the money. You can put this on my tab for settlement at the end of the month, and until then, you can pay cash to somebody for this amount. So your bank tells their bank, the recipient's bank, that yep, we got you. You know, put this on our tab, and we'll settle at the end of the day, or week, or month with the central bank, effectively. So it's really your credit that is making the payment. You know, when the recipient goes and takes cash from the bank that you sent them money to, they didn't send the physical cash. They didn't sell them the gold. They sent just their credit. They said their word, that they said we'll be good for this. And they are, usually. And that's why the recipient's bank will do this. So effectively, this is extremely fast technology, because, you know, you can send it with a telegram, with an email, with a message, almost instantaneously. You can communicate the information. So really, it is the credit that is done there. So you're providing an incentive now for that company to issue more credit, for those banks to issue more credit, to keep giving each other more credit, because every time they credit each other, they're effectively creating new money. And so I think the interesting thing about Bitcoin is that it offers us a way to mine money that is, you know, productive for society, that doesn't involve debt. So the limitation on the system, from on one hand, the traditional Austrian critique was that this system is going to have to collapse into hyperinflationary boom. And it has, of course, collapsed in many, many places. It's collapsed 60 times in the last 100 years or so all over the world. So it does collapse, of course, but it seems that in the US and in like the countries that have managed to implement monetarism, where what ends up happening is that the money is the reason it is collapsing, and the reason it is failing now, is not because of too much money, but because of too little money, because the money keeps disappearing, the money keeps collapsing, and because there's not enough money, because the more money you make, the less safe it is as a store of value. In other words, there's just not enough money being made by the fiat system, because not enough people are borrowing in the fiat system in order to justify, in order to produce high quality debt that is good enough for people to use as a store of value, right? In other words, it used to be that you would put your savings in gold or you would put them in gold-backed currency. Now, in order, you can't just put it in currency because the currency is getting devalued. So you have to put it in bonds and you have to put it in debt instruments. So you buy debt, essentially. You hold your savings in debt. And that seems like a great idea because now you know, you're financing people investing rather than just financing a lump of yellow rock sitting in a dark room. But there's a reason the lump of yellow rock sits in the dark room. It's because, you know, this is financing that needs to be available. It needs to be it needs to have no contingent claims on it. It needs to have no counterparty claim. It's money. So this system makes money impossible, more or less, as a store of value. And so people have to resort to credit, but there's just not enough credit being made. How do we know that? We know that because people are having to buy bonds with negative yield. You know, people are giving the government money for the pleasure of receiving a small return on it. For the pleasure of returning a part of it, effectively. So there's not enough credit being created because we can't just keep making more credit forever. And so the cash is not good as a store of value, and debt is no longer enough as a store of value. And Bitcoin is rising because people are putting their wealth, instead of saving it in debt, in the monetization of debt, they're saving it now in Bitcoin, in a hard asset that doesn't contain debt. In other words, instead of putting your wealth, storing your wealth in somebody lending money to somebody else, you know, instead of having your wealth stored in institutions that are lending money, you store it in something that just sits there digitally, not even in a room, and it's just there. It does nothing else but sit there available for you without any contingent other claims on it. So effectively, Bitcoin, this is what I'm trying to communicate in the fiat standard, that Bitcoin doesn't need for there to be a hyperinflationary scenario in order for it to rise. In fact, Bitcoin can rise in a deflationary scenario. It can rise because it'll be the store of value that people want in a world in which debt is dangerous and negative interest rates are predominant and there's no other way of saving for yourself for the future. In that world, we keep monetizing more Bitcoin, and because of Bitcoin's unique and proprietary number go up technology, the more that people use and save in Bitcoin, the more the price of Bitcoin goes up, the more attractive it becomes. And so this is essentially an infinite loop that we can just get into, and the more people get into it, the more they benefit from it, and the more they are protected from the pillage that is the fiat system. And so what I'm trying to communicate in the fiat standard is that basically Bitcoin can outcompete fiat by offering a better store of value than government bonds and all these other bonds. I think that's really the game that matters, and not to whip a dead horse again, not payments, obviously, and not coffee, and not small payment networks. What's going to really win the war is Bitcoin number go up, becoming a better store of value than bonds and corporate debt and stocks. That's how it does it. If that continues, if more and more sailors come and continue to do this, and Bitcoin continues to function as it does, and we don't get an inflationary fork, and we don't get an inflationary bug, and we continue to maintain the supply of Bitcoin as it is, then the world will just continue to work in this way. And I think that's how the advantage of fiat is wiped out in salability, because Bitcoin also has salability across space. It's got salability across space, and it's got salability across time, and so it can defang fiat without having to destroy it.
Yeah, one more question. Yep. Thank you for answering that. know, I guess it's a two-part question. One is probably not in line with your Austrian economics, but trying to understand why most of these hedge fund managers and investors don't understand this. Seems like a very simple concept. You know, the store of value aspect, you know, they're putting $20 trillion into these negative returning bonds. And so I'd love to get your thought on that. Is it just like they haven't educated themselves, which I find very surprising, but possible. And then the other thought is, you know, the barometer for the store of value market seems to be the real rate of inflation. You know, some people say it's 2%. Some people say, you know, it's 10%. I think Michael Saylor argued that it was 22% with the Fed printing, you know, money this last couple rounds. And very arguably, it's probably only going to get worse, as you were kind of alluding to, you know, more money printing. So could it be upward to 25%? So in a lot of ways, like, that's the pain. I like to think about it as every fiat dollar could be feeling a different amount of pain. $20 trillion in negative interest rates, they're feeling, you know, very obvious pain, and then they're losing money from a nominal and real rate. And then you have other bonds that are, you know, at 2% return that are losing purchasing power in terms of real numbers, but not nominal numbers. So I just wanted to get your thought on that. You know, how can $20 trillion sit there and they haven't figured it out? You know, have they not read your book? Have they not done their education? It seems very logical that that you'd move into a store of value. So yeah, one is just kind of their thought process. And then would that be an accurate way? Because I don't think about these narratives as much as just kind of these trenches of store of value debt that you almost mentioned, where, again, $20 trillion in negative returning debt. Like, how is that even possible, especially with a parachute like Bitcoin?
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, yeah, you could think about it. Why is it that there aren't enough people who have found out about Bitcoin yet? And then you could think the other way around is, honestly, if you told me 5 years ago that we'd be seeing what we see today with all of these big Wall Street names already putting in serious money into Bitcoin, I think I wouldn't have believed it. I think this is extremely, extremely fast. Like, I don't think we would have, I didn't think we would get this far this fast. It's still not easy to understand what is going on with Bitcoin. And it's still difficult to figure out how it works and how to, you know, to just basically grasp the essential concept of what it is that a private key, public key, cryptography does. What is it that you're actually doing with that? Simply understanding that that is something that is technically possible, that you can have private key, public key cryptography, and then trying to think about the implications of how this works for Bitcoin is not an easy thing for most people to do. It requires some time, it requires some reading. And then once you do that, then you start becoming you know, then you start becoming open to the possibility of how this thing could actually work. Because for most people, the initial aspect is it's a shady darknet thing that anybody can use. And so it's used by drug dealers and criminals and so on. So it takes some time to get over that. And it takes some time to figure out what's going on. And, you know, it's only... It's the quantity of content that is being created about Bitcoin has only really improved over the last couple of years. Before that, you know, wasn't that many people around the world who had access to this kind of thing. So it's not entirely clear to me that we could say that it is going slow. I think it's going incredibly fast. And I think we're at a point now where the scary thing is that you look at the kind of people who are getting into Bitcoin and the kind of people who are buying the Bitcoin value proposition. And it's people who basically have nothing in common from all over the world, nothing else in common. And so it's a message that is, it's not like, yes, you know, it's, say, it's just retirees, for instance, who grab it, or it's just millennials, or it's just, you know, people who live in places that are witnessing hyperinflation. it's really everybody. And even within, you know, intellectual schools or people on Wall Street, you know, people come from all kinds of different, you know, you've got tech software people like Michael Saylor, as well as hedge fund money managers, people, and, you know, traditional financial institutions and banks, all of them are coming to the same kind of conclusion about what is going on. So it's distributed. I think this is what's kind of scary about it, in that it's, you know, the small subset of money managers that have looked into Bitcoin in depth seem to have caught the bug. And the small subset of enterprise software companies like MicroStrategy that have looked into it in depth have caught the bug. But if they can catch it, then, you know, other fund managers and other software companies can also get it. It's not like it was only the software companies that got it, and then you'd think, well, this is a bridge too far for Wall Street, you know. So I think we're at a point where the virus has spread to all jurisdictions now, and you know, all intellectual jurisdictions have been compromised by Bitcoin effectively. And so it's now a matter of more of this happening and more of it spreading. But yeah, you're absolutely right. It's staggering when you think $20 trillion that are all being told, you know, it's not going to be a dollar next year. It's going to be 99, maybe 98, maybe 97. And, you know, you're just going to have to continue to pay for saving for the future. You can't just hold money. And even if you hold instruments, you will witness them decline in value. So yeah, Bitcoin's number go up fixes this. You're muted, Blake.
Oh, thank you, Safening. Yeah. You know, but what is your thought on that? Because the way that I see this dam breaking is even more bullish than Bitcoin Tina and Preston, is that, like, you know, if people start to get it this round, you know, that $20 trillion moving into Bitcoin will push the return on investment up, you know, to like say 200-300% or something like that long, which would send the market signal to the rest of the market that anything that's not getting that 200% return, you know, they need to sell and put into Bitcoin, you know, store of value, things like a home, and some of that other debt that you mentioned, you know. What are your thoughts on that? Because that's the barometer, you know. One kind of basic scenario is like the $20 trillion of negative interest rate debt moving in, where they're just like, all right, we just don't want to lose our money. Then you have the real nominal debt, let's call it, you know, that's under the let's say 8% inflation of the US money supply, you know, which is most debt. And then you have, like, as that debt's moving into Bitcoin, that's pushing the return on investment, or, you know, number go up technology up. And so, like, as that's having 200-300% returns, then I feel like everybody, any business person or rational person, is going to look at like their opportunity costs at that point. What's your kind of thought process on those different scenarios and how that would play out?
I think I'm going to have to be a party pooper here and pour big bucket of cold water, which is, I keep reminding people, there's going to have to be a point at which this leads to an unsustainable bubble and a giant crash. It's coming. Okay. So
the debt bubble or Bitcoin?
Yeah, good question. Well, I don't know much about the fiat markets. I don't like to prognosticate so much about them, but I think in the Bitcoin market, there's going to have to be another crash. And I hate to be a party pooper and to be a bear, but, you know, there will be a massive crash coming in Bitcoin. Doesn't matter how much money comes in, there will have to be a crash first. And then we may get another crash or whatever. But the reason is, currently we have 900 Bitcoins being produced every day. And there's just, the more money goes in to buy Bitcoin, the more of these $20 trillion go to buy Bitcoin, the more the price of these 900 Bitcoins being produced every day. So there has to be a point, you know, it doesn't matter whether, no matter how big the amount of money that comes in, eventually it gets to the point where it pumps the value of the new coins up so much
that the new money can't keep up with the increase in the value of the new coins. And therefore, that will lead to a crash, you know, because we're gonna we'll have the short squeeze, and then people will be over leveraged in the short squeeze. But you know, there'll be a lot of money wanting to come in when the price is going vertical, and that just causes it to go even more vertical. But then these people are over leveraged, and then they can't buy 3 months later anymore when the price is at the top and it can't go vertical anymore. So then there's less new buy support coming in because all these people are essentially over leveraged and not enough new money can come in. That tipping point has to come. No matter how much money comes in, you're going to have a point at which not as much money comes in, and then the new coins are massively inflationary, and then that leads to everybody who's leveraged to getting wrecked, and then you have a cascade of liquidations essentially, and then we come crashing back. But the incredible thing about Bitcoin's number go up technology is that we crash at a level higher than where we were last time. We crash above the since, say, after the in the previous market, we never crashed under the previous all-time high. And so, you know, the bottoms of each bear market continue to rise. So the previous one, we were at like 150, 200, and then the next one, we were at around 3,000. That was the bottom of this cycle. So we'll always have the bottom increasing. But there will always be these spikes. I think the nature of Bitcoin mining means that these spikes are inevitable, because when the value of the Bitcoin is little, a lot of money coming in, it pumps a lot, and then a lot of money goes up, and then the price goes up, and then that eventually it becomes too expensive, it goes down. Now, then when we have the halving, because the number of coins has dropped by half the next year, after that, we're able to pump more because more money can come in right now, and we only have half as much coins being produced. So this is really how the stock to flow model helps me think about how this works. So, to all of our Wall Street listeners, you know, I know you're all getting excited and you think, well, this time is different. It's our first bump. It's our first rodeo, and we're going to pump it to the moon. And, you know, we'll take it on from the hodlers. We were at the early stages, and you guys are coming in, and you're bringing in all of the fiat, and you're going to pump us to the moon. I have no doubt, but, you know, steady yourself. Fasten your seatbelts, because it's going to be a bumpy ride. It has to be bumpy. You know, it doesn't matter how many Michael Saylors and Paul Tudor Jones we throw at this. That dynamic, I think, will have to continue. There will be crashes and there will be spikes. It's just the way that the market works. And you could say that the fact that the mining is denominated in Bitcoin is what introduces this element of reflexivity in this market that causes these giant spikes to go up and then crash down. And the fact that the mining reward decreases as a percentage of the stockpile is what makes these crashes have this upward trend, I'd say.
And then to monopolize the conversation and all the questions, you know, what are your thoughts in terms of the knowledge being feels different this time? You know, one of the great things about Michael Saylor was saying that this is very path dependent. He read your book, he understood it. You know, I read your book early on and that clicked it for me. You know, bought it right away, bought it for all my friends. Again, thank you for writing it.
Thank you.
But it just was like, oh my gosh, pulling no punches type of book where you're like, you can't argue this. This is clear, you know, and I haven't heard you talk about, Hayek's knowledge in the economy. I forget the name of the book off the top of my head. I just forgot, but you know, what's your thought on that? You know, especially with the internet, the Michael Saylors of the world, creating hope.com, referencing, you know, your book and his podcast, you know, changing the dynamic this time, you know, or do you feel it'll just be the same kind of stock to flow model that we've kind of been talking about? Or how do you think that would be different a little bit this time? Or
I think it's going to be different in that we're going to have bigger numbers, basically. that's how it's always different. It's just, you know, we need all of this infrastructure, the financial infrastructure and the intellectual infrastructure and all the material and all of the online stuff that's available for people and the YouTube videos and the courses and everything that is being made about Bitcoin. We need all of that stuff in order to pump us into the next level. You know, and it's inevitable that Bitcoin, the amazing thing about it is that Bitcoin is essentially a self-financing startup that handles its own marketing because it infects people with the bug. And then people want to go and make material about it. You know, I quit my university job and now I'm just doing Bitcoin material and teaching about Bitcoin. And, you know, that wouldn't be possible without NGU technology, without Bitcoin's growing financial weight and without the economy of it rising, the value of it rising, you know, that wouldn't, that would not be possible. And so I think, the increase in the price leads to those things, and these things in turn lead to the increase in the price. It's the kind of cycle that Bitcoin has always had, but I don't see that it would make things different. Again, I still think, you know, this is why we are able to go from 1,000 to 100,000, maybe, or let's not count our chicken, but it's still 19 or 18. So this is how we can go from, you know, $18 to $18,000, because now there's a ton of YouTube videos and there are books and there are podcasts and there's so much information out there. That's how we can, you know, we can pump it to 18,000. That's how we can get that high. But the dynamic, I think, will still be the same. I think the new money will likely pump us high, but also come crashing down. And they'll learn their lesson, and then, you know, they'll learn the Matt Odell lesson of, you know, just stay humble and stack sats. And the next bull market, they'll be ready and more financially and emotionally prepared for handling the Bitcoin bull.
Yeah, so on that point, these guys are coming in with a fiat mindset, and they're going to be exiting with a fiat mindset. You know, like this smart money in air quotes that's going to come in huge amounts. They're not here for the reasons we're here for. They're here to make returns for their customers. And as soon as their investors start seeing, well, wait a minute, we're up 50%, we're up 70%, we're up 100%. When do we get out of this thing and just get back to fiat? That's, you know, and they're going to have analysts watching this whole time. When does that top look as though it's about to come in? Then there'll be a race out from all the hedge funds, all the smart money. This is the way they do it. Like they're of the fiat mindset. Michael Saylor is different, right? We all know that. So that is money that's coming in and he's going to take however many thousands of Bitcoin off the table. These guys, they're not. They're coming for fiat.
Yeah, but I think, you know, if they're able to do this in a way that is profitable for them, then they're helping smooth the volatility. If they do it in a way that's not profitable for them, then they're exacerbating the volatility for us. So I think it'll be interesting to see how different approaches of risk management fare in Bitcoin. And that's another topic for potential research. I mean, if you think about it, how do portfolio managers and money managers rebalance and think about positioning when you witness something appreciate so much? We've not had assets that regularly and astonishingly appreciate as much as Bitcoin has been doing in the last period. So maybe this might be worth digging into to see how they do it. And I think, you know, some of the tricks that work in fiat will work. Some of them might not. It'll be interesting to watch how that unfolds. Anybody else? But I don't, I should add, you know, I don't have much of the feeling of expectation that, you know, that they should do this or they should do that. And if they don't do this, then they shouldn't do that. I think, you know, Bitcoin is good enough. Bitcoin's big enough to take care of itself, I think.
And here's another question. Bitcoin seems so much more obvious than previous technologies for one main reason. I mean, when Microsoft was maybe being pitched in boardrooms and having conversations, like it was hard to believe that we'd have cell phones and personal computers and things of that nature. It was very hard to understand because it's never happened before, even if you were talking about Moore's Law. But with Bitcoin, it seems much more obvious, you know, thousands of years of economic history, you know, I guess the common takeaway is that hard money always wins. Kind of what's your thought on that statement? Like, you know, since you've done so much history on or research on this and written a book on it, like, doesn't it give you so much confidence that you've looked through these millions of use cases over history, you know, the yapstones and things of that nature, where it's just like hard money always wins. There's not an example where it doesn't win, like, you know, especially over a certain amount of time. What's your thought on that?
I mean, you know, fiat is kind of an exception. Within fiat currencies, yes, the hardest fiats win, but also within the Bitcoin, within wider monetary competition, fiat kind of displaced gold, even though gold is harder. It's not only about the hardest. I think this is how the fiat standard is helping me sharpen my thinking. It's also, you know, because the Bitcoin standard was mostly about saleability across time. But I think, you know, saleability across space also had to do with fiat's success. It wasn't just that governments made it illegal because, you know, it's been 100 years. And if it was just, you know, government making it illegal, like I like to use the example of the Soviet Union and jeans. They used to ban jeans and now the Soviet Union is gone and Russians still wear a lot of jeans. But it wasn't 100 years of banning jeans. There's more to this than just government banning, because if it was just government banning, people would have found a way around it. It's also about the saleability across time, across space, I mean. So I guess this is Bitcoin's weak link in a sense. This is Bitcoin's Achilles heel. If its saleability across space is limited and handicapped by government, then that could make its hardness still prevent it from still not be enough to make it the hardest money. I guess this is how I would formulate the bear case for Bitcoin. Anybody else have any other questions? All right. Well, thank you everybody for joining. This was a lot of fun and we'll be doing more of these sessions and I will see you next week. Take care.